I am speaking today to Dr. Ryan Howell. He's an associate professor of psychology at San Francisco State University and a co-founder of BeyondThePurchase.org, which he and his colleagues developed to explore the well-being costs and benefits of different purchasing and money management choices and the motivation behind these purchases. He's the director of the Personality and Well-Being Lab at San Francisco State University, which focuses on identifying factors to remedy human problems and cultivate that which help people thrive. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Ryan.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a bit more about the Personality and Well-Being Lab? How does this work?
Oh, sure. It really is like a fancy name for me and my graduate students and our undergraduate students and a big physical space with lots of computers where we sit around and devise different types of studies and surveys. We just all name our labs, and so it sounds cooler to call it that than you know, like Ryan's Lab or something like that.
Absolutely. And so a lot of your focus at this point is on financial aspects and the financial aspects of thriving and well-being. Can you discuss some of your research?
Sure. I mean, we've done a lot of work. You know, a sort of quick summary is almost 10 years ago, we started doing work in developing countries trying to figure out if money was more strongly related to happiness than it is in our developed country, looking at poor Malaysian farmers, how much money they have and how happy they are, and found that the relationship is obviously much stronger when you have less money. But that led us to ask the question about, well, you know, are there certain types of choices that people can make that will actually improve their happiness, certain types of financial choices people can make that will improve their happiness? And since that time, we've looked at, you know, if people put money towards investments and savings, will that make them happier? And the answer is yes. If they spend their money more on life experiences and material items, will that make them happier? And the answer is yes. And if the motivations are more intrinsic and internal, as opposed to other focus, you know, trying to impress people, if those will make people happy, and the answer is yes. And so we've done a lot of work in the last 10 years, you know, to basically show that you can spend your money in ways that will make you happy.
And when you talk about investments, is this the idea that people are just thinking about their future, preparing for their family? Is that what brings the sense of well-being and happiness?
I think really it's more of a sense of financial security, to be honest
right.
with you. If you think about, you know, there's been a lot of news lately, and I have, you know, wonderful colleagues in this field, and there's been this, you know, movement that, you know, buying a house won't make you happy, so you shouldn't do it. And I agree with that, actually. I don't think that, you know, buying a house will actually change your happiness a whole lot. You know, maybe if you get out of a bad situation into a better one, that's one thing. But, you know, getting another room or another 1,200 square feet or something probably won't change your happiness. But I don't think it's, you know, some purchases aren't really about happiness. And this is what investments and, you know, savings and making sure that you have a stable future is about. It's a little bit less about happiness and more about the sense that you'll be taken care of when times go bad. And if we think back to the financial crash, really what happened more than anything is that people, you know, savings rates had actually dropped to a negative percent, meaning that people actually had more money going out than going into banking accounts on average. And so there was just too many people living paycheck to paycheck. And what that meant was when you actually had a situation where, you know, the economy really hit, you know, a real bad time, people didn't have the security to say, well, okay, we're in a pretty big bump in the road right here right now, but I'm going to be okay because I have these investments that I could cash out if I needed to. I have this savings account that I can liquidate very easily. And so really what I think that you see is that investments and savings have a huge impact on making you feel secure, which is, you know, if you look at Maslowian needs, it's the second, and right after basically food and shelter, it's the second most important need.
And there's also been a lot of studies about general, the amount of income, and I think that the top income was something like $65,000, after which there's almost diminishing returns in terms of happiness. Have you all looked at that as well?
Right. You know, and we have a paper, and when people talk about, and this is a little bit of a complex situation, so give me a couple of seconds to try and pull all this together. When people talk about the fact that money doesn't make you happy, a lot of the studies that they've been looking at and pointing to really over the past 30 years has been the relationship between a person's typically household income, so that's what it should be, though sometimes those studies are personal income, which makes very little sense, to be honest with you, if you have two income earners. But it's income that they're really looking at, and they're really not looking at any other economic factor. So, for example, if I have $50,000 of household income and you have $50,000 of household income, they would expect us to have the same level of happiness, even if you have $50,000 of debt and I have $0 of debt. So I think when you're looking at these types of studies, you know, what you do see is that about $75,000 is what Daniel Kahneman said. Wolfer said it's at about $120,000. That there's this, you know, point of sort of no return where you don't get any happier or any, you know, or not marginally happier. And again, that's sort of the type of happiness that they're looking at that point is really daily happiness. So how much joy do you feel in a day-to-day moment? But I still think that there's a bit of a problem with those types of studies because they're really only focusing in on how much income you have, and they're not taking in a lot of other economic factors. And most of the studies that we've conducted show that household income plays a very modest role in your overall well-being. And again, things like how much money you have in savings, how little credit card debt you have, how much you have in investment plays a much larger role. So, you know, it's tough to say that money doesn't buy you happiness if you're really only looking at one of them, you know, maybe the least important factors.
Absolutely. It's so complex, and we get so wrapped up, our identities get wrapped up in money sometimes, it seems, to a very detrimental extent. Talk a little bit about experiences, how you found that spending money on experiences make people happy.
Yeah, so what we started to think about, and you know, to be, you know, in full disclosure here, I'm not the first person to say this. You know, there was a whole series, you know, of Greek philosophers who had argued this. Humanists, you know, from the 60s and 70s had suggested this, and Leif Van Boven was actually the first person to empirically demonstrate it back in 2003. What we really wanted to do is say, okay, it really looks like there's mounting evidence here that if you spend your money on life experiences instead of material items, you're going to be happier with those types of financial choices, both in the moment and down the road. So just think about if you're walking through a mall and you really have, you know, you're sort of seeing two sides of the aisle. And one side of the aisle you see, like, I could go get, you know, nice clothes or gadgets or whatever. And on the other side, I could get a nice massage. And you're going to think to yourself, well, you know, which one of these two should I actually spend my money on if I want to be happier? And it is important to remember that that's not a small caveat there, right? This really is with the intention of making yourself happier and not for some sort of non-discretionary reason. And what we basically see is time and time again, and this has really been demonstrated in pretty much every study that's ever conducted this, is that people, if they spend their money on life experiences, like going out to eat with their friends or going to a movie or a baseball game or going to different types of concerts, that they, you know, see that as a, you know, better return on their sort of happiness investment than clothes and jewelry and shoes and gadgets. And the major reason for that is, well, there's several reasons, but I think the one that we really focus in on is the huge social component that naturally comes with buying a life experience. So when you actually spend your money on life experiences, most of the time it's very social. Even if it's not, you know, you with your friends, it might be you with your family, or it might even be you by yourself, but in a social environment. When you go to read a book alone in a coffee shop, there are still people you're interacting with. And there's not this natural social component with our material items. You know, sometimes certainly some purchases do that, you know, different types of game boards will obviously do that, but it's not a sort of natural ingredient that comes along with these things. And our happiness is so intertwined with, you know, getting along well with others, that's the huge hedonic advantage that we see in life experiences.
Well, social connection really has proven to be, and we're going to talk about the happiness survey in just a few minutes, but social connection is such a huge part of people's well-being, particularly as they get older, but certainly also as you're younger. And I was going to say that I've heard these results before over the years, and so I'm wondering, were people surprised at the results of your study? And do these results go anywhere besides having a media component that educates public? Does it change people's behavior to know this?
Yeah, you know, that's really interesting to me. So you mentioned in the beginning that we run this website, beyondthepurchase.org. And, you know, it was, you know, quite honestly, it was several interviews back in 2009 when people would talk to me about my results. And invariably, if it was a call-in show, people seemed to be a little bit surprised by the results, or, you know, people would say, oh, I never really, you know, what I heard more than surprise was, I never really thought about that. I never really thought that, you know, these material items would not buy me happiness. As if no one had ever posed the question, well, if I have these two choices, which is the better way to spend my money? And then we started conducting a series of interviews, and we sort of asked people, you know, why did you spend your money on this? And, you know, did you think it would make you happier? And, you know, do you continue in the sort of, you know, cycle of buying? I mean, you know, certainly some people continue to spend money on material items, you know, in the face of sort of mounting evidence, you know, interpersonally that it's not making them happier. So why do they do that? And so I think really the simplest answer is that people just don't sit around like I do and think about how people spend their money day in and day out and how it makes them happy. So that's really part of the reason that we developed the website, was because people were telling us, you know, I actually changed my buying behavior as a result of being in your study, or I actually started to change the way I spent my money as a result of taking your survey. So we have only, unfortunately, anecdotal evidence at this point that, you know, this sort of information, one, does seem a little bit novel, like people don't necessarily think about it day in and day out, and two, that they actually do seem to, you know, change their behavior as a result of learning that information. Right now we're in the process of trying to see, you know, if we give people this type of information, will it really change them? And if it doesn't, then there must be some sort of barrier that's beyond just knowledge. And so that's kind of where we're at right now with that.
And this whole, these studies and the whole talk about happiness and what makes us is part of this new, kind of a relatively recent branch of psychology called positive psychology. Can you tell us a little bit about how positive psychology developed out of psychological studies?
Sure. Well, all the credit goes to Marty Seligman, who was the APA president in 1999. He actually is known for, you know, besides founding essentially positive psychology, the researcher who discovered learned helplessness in animals in the 1970s, and if you're not familiar with learned helplessness, it's basically that, you know, if you experience a certain number of traumas in a short period of time, eventually you just sort of give up and stop fighting the trauma. So it's not exactly the, you know, sort of brightest and cheeriest sort of, you know, series of studies. I mean, you have to basically shock dogs until they, you know, will no longer, you know, fight the shock.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it sounds really tough. But this is what he was doing. And one of the things that he mentions is one of the things he could never get away from, and this is one of the, you know, predominant questions we get in psychology is, well, does it always happen? And he was, well, of course not. There's about probably a third of the dogs who would be sort of what he called resilient, that he could never get them to a point of actually experiencing learned helplessness. And it made him think, you know what, why are we focusing so much on the sort of dark side of human behavior? Why don't we spend a little bit of our time trying to figure out, you know, what about people, you know, takes them to their sort of, you know, highest points of human experience? And there's a lot of humanist theorists, again, who had argued that to really understand how we should flourish in life, we can't just sort of look at the opposite of negativity. So I can't, you know, just say, well, if I take all of these things that help a person, you know, alleviate some sort of addiction or some sort of trauma or some sort of series of depression, if I just keep telling them to do those same types of things, that they'll move from dysfunction into flourishing. And what we find is that most of psychology had been focusing on moving people out of, you know, a place of suffering into a place of functioning, but they sort of stopped there. And so what Seligman said in 99 is, look, we need to, you know, work with how do we take people from functioning to flourishing, and that the types of mental activities people will engage in and the types of, you know, behavior that people engage in will probably be very different. And so that happened, that call to psychology happened right about the time I was actually entering graduate school in 1999-2000. And one of the leaders in that field, Sonia Lubomirsky, happened to be at my university and taught a class in 2003 that I took, which is how I got involved in positive psychology. But you're right. I mean, if you look at the history of psychology, we've only been around for about 100 years, and maybe only 15 of those has positive psychology been trying to understand what makes life worth living.
And then some of the classes, like at Harvard, we're saying, are overflowing now of positive psychology. There were, you know, 300 people on the waiting list or something crazy. So
yeah.
Obviously there are a lot of people who are yearning to see something a little bit more positive. And correct me, I'd heard kind of a fun little anecdote about Seligman's daughter kind of fussing, and he got mad at her. And
yeah.
You can tell me if it's incorrect. And she said, you know, you said that if I worked on not whining, you would work on being less grumpy or something to that effect. Is that correct?
Yeah, he talks about it in his book. I've never heard him tell the story personally, but she, you know, Marty is probably admittedly not the most bright and cheery person, you know, dispositionally. And so he was out in, you know, the garden, and he was weeding or something, and he was doing something. And his daughter at the time was about 5 years old, and she was basically picking the weeds up and throwing them up in the air, and I think he got upset at her. And that's the line that she gives is, you know, if I were to, you know, work on some of the things, you would be work on being less grumpy, which caused him to think, well, you know, maybe we can actually learn about what people who are really happy, what they do. And that's really the call of psychology, positive psychology at least. You know, why don't we look at people who are doing really well and try and figure out what makes them different from people who aren't doing as well, or even just you know, kind of going in, you know, and just sort of living life.
Well, it's certainly a reminder that we can also learn a huge amount of happiness from children.
Yes, that's very true.
We haven't been indoctrinated yet,
yeah,
right?
You know, from the mouth of babes, of course. Yeah, so that story, I think, if I remember correctly, it happens before, you know, I think in the mid-90s at that point on the timeline, and it sort of encourages him to think that we should develop a science that sort of focuses on human flourishing. And, I mean, it's really taken off. I mean, Seligman in and of himself had a huge influence not on bringing together, you know, 20 of the brightest people and sort of encouraging them to engage in positive psychology, but really got Gallup to focus in on strengths and thriving. And if you look at Gallup polls now, they focus just as much on you know, how well places are doing as to, you know, how poorly they're doing.
Well, and speaking of Gallup poll, you developed the Happiness Survey for Happiness Seattle. Yeah. Now, Happiness Santa Fe has also recently launched this April, and we are also using your survey, which is really interesting. And I would love to know a little bit about how you developed that using the 10 domains and how we can make that really statistically valuable as a tool.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'll try and gloss over a lot of the boring details of, you know, psychometric, you know, validation. The sort of key components there is that, you know, once you establish that you know what you want to try and measure, so if you want to try and measure time balance, or you want to try and measure self-reported health, or, you know, flourishing, which is really sort of the mental well-being section and things like that, you know, that you can begin to say, well, look, you know, a lot of people have asked a lot of these different types of questions. And so I happened to be talking with John and Laura, I guess it was almost 2 years ago now, who were running Sustainable Seattle at that time and turned into the Happiness Institute. And I remember that they were trying to select items and questions, you know, to fill these domains. And I told them, you know, that there are procedures that you can use to actually, you know, use these items, you know, to cull down to the best, you know, ones. And so it's still, unfortunately, because you're trying to measure so many domains, I mean, 10's a lot, actually, to be quite honest.
Yes.
The survey isn't as short as I think we would hope it would be. So I encourage everyone to take it because it's a wonderful survey, and I apologize it'll take up a little bit more of your time than some of our shorter surveys. But, you know, I think that what we've learned is that, and this is what I think has always been great about HI and their work, is that they sort of are trying to marry objective you know, metrics with subjective metrics. So, for example, imagine you live in an area that is actually objectively, you can measure the crime rate there. Well, it's really interesting to sort of also ask people how safe they feel there. And you can sort of see, you know, there's two obvious situations that could occur. You could live in a safe area and know it, or you could live in a high crime area and feel it. But what about those sort of off-diagonal responses? What if, you know, the crime statistics actually say you don't feel safe, or that, you know, that you're in an unsafe area and you actually say that you feel safe? You know, I live in San Francisco, and I have a lot of friends who live over in Oakland, and I think it's a pretty scary place, to be quite honest with you. But to a person, they always tell me that they don't feel, you know, the wave of crime. And so that should tell us something that's particular about Oakland that would be different than if they were actually saying, yeah, I don't go out, you know, after night. And so that's really what the sort of goal of the subjective sort of side is to try and find these 10 really important domains that really Bhutan, you know, to be quite honest with you, identified back in 1973. And try and get people's impressions of how well their life is going and not just rely on sort of objective metrics that are easy to quantify.
Now, these domains, they include financial security, time balance, environmental quality, education, access to arts and culture, confidence in government, physical health, mental health, work satisfaction, which was added here for the West, and social connection, as we had mentioned before. I should say as well that we can take your survey by going to happinesssantafe.org, which connects back to Happiness Seattle. And so the results of this, if they have at all, how have they been turned into policy in any way?
Well, I think that, you know, to be quite honest with you, all happiness researchers are still trying to find the right way to use happiness metrics to inform policymakers. And I think that sometimes policymakers want us to sort of reduce, our number of questions down to a sort of a simple series of questions that provide a simple deliverable about how to change things. And if and this is my opinion. I don't want to speak for HI, or Happiness or Seattle, because I think that in many ways, the right place to go is to try and identify where there might be strengths and weaknesses in a community, and then do what we call participatory action research, which is where you actually take the results back to the community and say, hey, does this jive with what you're feeling? So, for example, imagine you're in Santa Fe. I imagine you would be pretty much, happier with your access to culture than most places in the United States. Mm-hmm. But imagine you said, you didn't. And I brought this information to you, and you're like, oh, well, now that I see those scores, I don't really feel like that's a weakness in our community. Maybe I didn't understand the question or something like that. The ultimate goal would be to bring the results back to community and then have the community come up with their own series of solutions that government officials can then implement. People's centered solutions for the government to sort of implement. So if you were to ask people in LA, do you want bike lanes, which is something that's very, very important to Portland, you might hear that that's one, not a really big, huge desire, but two, you might also realize that that's not really feasible because of the way that LA is set up. So that's, I think, the sort of, it's a more complex solution. And I think that one of the things that people have to realize when you're looking at something like happiness metrics is I can't just give you a score and then have a really obvious solution, because each place is going to have a different type of solution.
But again, at least get people really thinking about it and thinking about kind of larger scale, domains in their life that might need to improve or not, right?
Right, and of course, if you take it at the person level, I think the single best thing that you can do is ask people questions that they sometimes are not. This to me is probably the most remarkable part of the survey process, because, for the most part, when we hand people surveys, we don't really anticipate that they're going to have some sort of change in their thought process. It's almost as if we expect that all of us are sitting around thinking about these same types of questions. And a lot of times people aren't. They aren't thinking about if they have good time balance. They aren't thinking about if they're really that financially secure. They aren't thinking about if they really would like to live in a place, that has certain types of attributes, certain types of, qualities, as opposed to another. A lot of times they're just not thinking about these questions. And so the survey, surprisingly, at sort of its lowest level, delivers on that. It allows them to start thinking about, what do I really want out of life? And what kind of changes do I want to make interpersonally? And, of course, some of those changes, need to be supported by, state and local governments. But some of them are going to be things like, if you really want to have better time balance, maybe you need to make certain types of choices about how you spend your Friday evening.
Well, so often people come to these conclusions after really a life-threatening experience, maybe a loss of a loved one. So this is a much easier way to kind of start thinking about these things when you're not reaching these extreme life events, right?
Yeah, you don't want to have existential angst be the first time that you think about why,
exactly.
what's the purpose in life, and what's the, what is the good life to you? That's really, to be quite honest with you.
Right.
I think if we have any struggle in positive psychology, it's that we're trying to be scientists. Really, we are. And I don't think anyone would argue that. But we're almost asked more than we may even feel comfortable doing to be like doctors and give prescriptions about how to make people happier. And when I tell people that I'm a happiness researcher, there's really only two responses that I get, besides people sort of saying, you can do that. The first response is usually people tell me what makes them happy, which is great. It's very interesting to hear. But the second most common response is, what can I do to be happy? And so I think that, we struggle with that. We struggle with trying to think about, how do we best tell people how to live their lives?
Well, it's so subjective. It will be different for each person, right?
Right. And I think that what I would say, so if you get back to sort of our own research on buying life experiences, one of the things that I tell people is, I never intended to try and give you a shopping list of how you should spend your money in order to make yourself happy. That really wasn't my intention. It is people who are buying a bunch of material items, accumulating a bunch of stuff, they're the ones who are telling me that they're unhappy. And I'm just sort of, in many ways, reporting the results back to them. Right. And so I think that one of the things that we do well with, any type of survey like this, is we allow a person to think about How do they personally define the good life? Because we define it very differently. I mean, even if you look at, you know, Ginny Tsai's work down at Stanford, she'll show that there's huge cross-cultural differences in the type of life that people want to lead in the United States and in Southeast Asia. Just the types of emotions we want to experience. I mean, some people want really high arousal, strong positive emotions. And some people just want to be calm and chill. And so, you know, if you ask a person, are you experiencing a lot of joy, which is a high arousal emotion, versus are you feeling really relaxed, not only do you not necessarily know, you know, if they really, quote, understand that cross-cultural, but you don't really know if they value that. And so part of what I think that these surveys do is it just helps you give a, you know, sort of an internal check on what your value systems are and what you want out of life. And then theoretically you can sort of, you know, carve your own path towards those types of emotions and experiences.
We have just a few minutes here. I'm speaking with Ryan Howell. But there, happiness and positivity is not always seen in a very good light. There was a recent article in Yes Magazine, you know, Get Apocalyptic, and it's, you know, referring to the multiple cascading ecological crises, everything else happening in the world. And he has this quote, you know, when all the world darkens, looking on the bright side is not a virtue, but a sign of irrationality. How do you address people who just say, you all are being naive here?
Well, I think part of it is, you know, to be quite honest with you, it's the choice of words, right? I mean, so happiness sort of connotes this, you know, happiness is ignorance and, you know, this sort of peppy cheerleader type of persona. And that's not really what we're talking about. I mean, then if you go back to the well-being survey, I mean, there's only a few questions on happiness of which, you know, I don't think are really, to be quite honest with you, all that long or maybe even that important. You know, when you're talking about well-being, if you're talking about high quality of life, I mean, these are not sexy words that get picked up in the New York Times. And so in many ways, I think part of the problem is just the word that we use. Happiness sort of leads to this, you know, impression of, you know, cheerful ignorance. But that's not really what we're talking about. You know, if you go back to what Marty Seligman said and what a lot of these surveys are trying to get at, it's the good life. And so the good life probably is a sustainable future for your children. It probably is, you know, having certain types of virtues like patience and prudence and things like that. And so, you know, for me, what I would say is, yeah, if all you're trying to do is get a person to experience, you know, maximal joy with minimal pain, you know, just sort of pure hedonic pleasure, then it probably is a naive view of what, you know, what what the world is and, you know, how to sort of solve different types of problems. But that's really not what we're trying to talk about. If you're trying to talk about, like, you know, what is the good life? The good life is much more complex and much deeper than that. You know, the single most important question on how people are doing quite often is, do you feel like you have purpose in life? And that's very different than, do you experience a lot of joy today?
Well, we hope to have this conversation a few more times throughout the year as well. So perhaps you'll join us again. Dr. Ryan Howell, Associate Professor of Psychology at San Francisco State University and co-founder of BeyondThePurchase.org. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
I did want to note that we have lost a member of the KSFR family today, Diego Mulligan, this week, recently, and the Diego Family Memorial Fund has been opened at the Los Alamos National Bank. People wanting to make contributions can go to any Los Alamos National Bank branch and make a deposit. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll be speaking with journalist Russ Baker about surveillance. So we'll put a positive spin on that.